we're just responding to Roe's claim that there's no reason for God to hide his reasons for preventing evil from us. Why does God, and why should God, hide his reasons from us? Now we have to respond that, at least in part, our response would be that God has given us reasons, that he has given us good reasons for thinking that, one, we don't understand everything that God is up to. We can't always follow the paths of God and understand God's reasoning for doing certain things. Though, two, often in the long run, we see and appreciate the work of God as a loving Heavenly Father. Think of Hebrews 12, how God, since he loves us, chastises us and gives us things to overcome, gives us, in a word, discipline, that we might learn his way. Consider Psalm 119 again, referred to earlier, verse 67, 71, and 75. There David says, until I knew your law, I went astray. In fact, he says, before you afflicted me, I went astray, but now I know and appreciate your law. God uses pain as a megaphone to us, and it's one of the most effective tools that I know of to get and hold the human being's attention. Now, in section 2 of the 1979 article by Roe, The Problem of Evil and Varieties of Atheism, Roe recommends that the best sort of response the theist can make is along the following lines. Isn't that interesting that in his article, he tries to point out the best sort of defense that the theist can respond to Roe's argument with? Now, this best procedure, according to Roe, is based on what he calls the G.E. Moore shift. G.E. Moore, again, is a philosopher that Roe approves of very much and accepts his ethical theory, as well as has learned a lot from Moore as a philosopher. The G.E. Moore shift is based upon two logically equivalent arguments. If you have two logically equivalent arguments whose first premise and conclusion in both of the arguments are, in fact, switched around and negated, okay, then in effect you'll have a logically equivalent argument, one whose conclusion is, let's say, a certain thing, and the other whose conclusion is based on the negation of the conclusion of the first argument. Okay, now it's going to be much better to appreciate this if we look at it schematically. So consider these two arguments. Once again, write this down on paper in your notebook if you have a notebook there in front of you to do so. Write these in a vertical columnar form. Okay, argument one. Now, these letters will represent different premises leading to a conclusion. So argument one, P, and then, secondly, Q, therefore, R. Now, argument two is this. Not R, Q, therefore, at the bottom of the column, your conclusion is not P. Now, these two arguments, as a truth of logic itself, if one is valid, then the second must be valid. Notice that the middle premise stays exactly the same, Q. Q is similar and the same to both premises, to both arguments. Remember also that in Roe's original formulation of his argument, he thought that his second premise was accepted by both theist and atheist. Do you see what's coming now? In effect, Q remains the same in both arguments. But what he claims the theist's best move is to negate the conclusion of his evidential argument from evil. He concluded that, therefore, the theistic God does not exist. But, in effect, we'll put that now as a theistic response to Roe's argument, and what Roe calls the best response the theist can make. We'll put that as our first premise, the negation of Roe's conclusion. So what's the negation of the theistic God does not exist? Well, the negation is it does not follow that, or it is not the case that the theistic God does not exist. In other words, our first premise is there exists the theistic God, or there exists an omnipotent, omniscient, holy, good being. That's our first premise. That's not our, okay? When we go back to the schematic diagram we have, that's not R. The theistic God exists. Q is the original premise of Roe's argument. Number two, an omniscient, holy, good being would prevent the occurrence of any intense suffering it could, unless it could not do so without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. Now, the conclusion from that argument. Remember the premises. It more or less says, God exists. God would prevent the occurrence of any intense suffering he could, unless he could not do so without thereby losing some greater good. And therefore, what's the conclusion? Well, it's the opposite. It's the negation of Roe's first premise. The same premise with an argument behind it. So we conclude not P, and it's this. It is not the case that there exists instances of intense suffering which an omnipotent, omniscient being could have prevented without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. Now, both arguments, if one is valid, the other is valid. If one is logically valid, the other must be valid, because all you've done is made a simple logical change between the two arguments, which in fact preserves truth value. It preserves the truth-making value of the form of the argument. What in effect, though, is Roe saying by employing the G.E. Moore shift in favor of the theism, of the theist? What Roe is doing is he's saying, look, theist, the best response you can make is this. Put together, marshal all the arguments, all the evidence you have for God's existence, and let that serve as premise one. And then accept premise Q, or premise two, which says that God would prevent the occurrence of any intense suffering it could, unless he could not do so without thereby losing some greater good. And then conclude from that, that it is not the case that there exist instances of intense suffering, which God could have prevented without thereby losing some greater good. Okay, you see what he's up to? Rather than saying that there's instances that are problematic, and if the world exists, there would be no problematic instances, therefore God does not exist, Roe is saying that the theist's best response is to take a logically equivalent argument to his and to respond in this way. God does exist. If God exists, there would not, in reality, be troublesome evils in the world. Therefore, there are not, in reality, troublesome evils in the world. And that leaves the whole space for there to be seemingly troublesome evils in the world. So Sue suffers, and it seems to be troublesome. It seems to show that God is not a loving God. But in fact, the theist has great evidence for thinking that God does exist. And therefore, trusting that he does and that he is who he says he is, for example, in scriptures, we trust that God does have a reason, even though we can't see that reason, or we can't see that reason in full at this time. Now, it's interesting to point out that as theists, we believe there's good evidence for thinking that the theistic Christian God exists. we think of the evidence of the veracity and life-changing power of the Scriptures, the historical background to the life of Christ, his sinlessness, his ministry among the poor and people in need, finally his death, prophecies fulfilled, and ultimately his resurrection, post-resurrection appearances, and his ascension into heaven, the sending of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost, the work of the church, the foundation of it, and so forth and so on, religious and mystical experience. Also the traditional arguments for God's existence, why there is something rather than nothing, the argument for God's existence based solely on the definition of God, the ontological argument, and the teleological argument, the argument that says that because the world exhibits design, that only a supernatural, intelligent, purposeful mind could have brought about, there therefore exists a supernatural, intelligent, purposeful, teleological designer behind the world. And that designer is our Lord Jesus Christ. Rowe himself has looked at all the different arguments in his textbook, 1978, The Philosophy of Religion, and Introduction. He himself thinks that, also in his 1975 work, The Cosmological Argument, a very fine text on that argument, Rowe himself thinks that there is some justification for thinking that God exists from these arguments. However, he doesn't think that they're ultimately successful, that there has to be certain assumptions assumed in order to make the argument go through. We've already said that in the context of Leibniz, Leibniz held to the principle of sufficient reason. And Rowe more or less says in his book on the cosmological argument that if PSR is true, then the cosmological argument is true. But we don't know for sure if the principle of sufficient reason is true. That was the principle that for everything that occurs, or for everything that is a certain way, that thing must have a sufficient reason for its being that way rather than some other way. If that principle is true, Rowe says, then the cosmological argument is successful. It would prove that there is an independently existing being that could well be God, the creator of the world and sustainer. However, we don't know PSR to be true. It's certainly useful. We find PSR as a principle to be very useful. If I'm in the room and my book's on the table, I leave to go out for 5 minutes and come back and the book's not there, the PSR principle kicks in. I believe that there must be some sufficient reason for explaining why my book has disappeared. And I don't believe that the book has just poofed, disappeared into nothingness. I wouldn't accept that as a suitable response to, hey, where has my book gone? I'd rather suspect that someone has taken it, that there's been a purposeful, intentional activity on a part of another individual to remove the book. And so in a similar way, the theist would say, look, we don't believe in universes popping into existence out of nothing, even though the quantum physicist might want us to believe that. Given enough time, the world, through some vacuum process, could pop into existence. We find that nonsensical. And so it seems to me that the proofs for God's existence, that they are at least justify belief in God as something that's not irrational. They actually make belief in God, other things being equal, rational to believe. However, what Rowe seems to be saying is that the evil of Sue's suffering is so bad, and the evil of the fawn suffering is so bad, that it completely defeats, it overcomes, it undercuts all the evidence that the theist might be able to gather for God's existence. At least this is the way he sees it. And so in the last part of his article, he argues for what he calls a position called friendly atheism. And his claim here is that a person could be justified to be an atheist, and yet he could be wrong about that. In the same way, a person could be a theist and have justificatory evidence for being a theist, and yet he or she could be wrong about that. And therefore, Rose says, I have evidence based on evil in the world, but I could be wrong about that. And therefore, the position to take is one of friendly atheism, not to be so dogmatic about my atheism based on evil, there is no God, but rather to be somewhat open, committed to my position, and yet realizing that I could be wrong. And so he gives this example. He says, suppose your friends see you off on a flight to Hawaii. Hours after takeoff, they learn that your plane has gone down at sea. After a 24-hour search, no survivors have been found. Now, under these circumstances, they are rationally justified in believing that you have perished. But it is hardly rational for you to believe this as you bob up and down in your life vest, wondering why the search planes have failed to spot you. Indeed, to amuse yourself, Roe continues, to amuse yourself while awaiting your fate, you might very well reflect on the fact that your friends are rationally justified in believing that you are now dead, a proposition you disbelieve and are rationally justified in disbelieving. End quote. So as you're sitting out in the ocean, bobbing up and down, wondering why you haven't been found yet, you could amuse yourself by thinking, you know, my friends back in Topeka could and are in fact justified in believing that I'm dead, but I could hardly believe that because I know for sure that I'm alive bobbing up and down in my life vest. So the idea is that the person bobbing up and down is justified in believing that they're alive, and yet the friends back in Topeka are rationally justified in believing that you have perished in the going down of this flight. Now, once again, return and think about the theist's position. I've talked about all the different types of evidence, ranging from the evidence for the Christian faith based on Christ's life, death, resurrection, and ministry, and also the traditional religious and mystical experience, the school that deals with mysticism, and also the traditional arguments for God's existence. And perhaps there's other evidences as well, based on our personal lives going about in the world and seeing God's hand at work, protecting us or leading us in different ways. These are all evidentiary grounds for thinking that God exists. However, a stronger way to think about them is to combine all these things within a theory. And this is the very thing that Christian theism attempts to do, is to combine the ontological, teleological, cosmological, moral, all these arguments into one theory so that together they can form a net or a web that will be much stronger than the ontological argument, say, taken alone. And so what we do, in effect, is come up with what has been called by some to be a cumulative case. Cumulative case. Now, what's a cumulative case? Well, it comes down to this. A cumulative case is where you argue for God's existence based on all of the different evidence. Evidence that God is the creator. Evidence that God exists based on the very definition of God. Evidence that God exists based on the moral order which we see around us. Evidence that God exists based on the ministry of Christ, his death and resurrection, the miracles that surround the scriptures, their veracity, life-changing power, and so forth. So you put them together into a cumulative case. Now, let's give an example of how this cumulative case works. Say, for example, that you're in a room with no windows. You're all closed in doing some work within that room. A friend knocks on the door and enters. And you notice that the friend has a raincoat on. And he says, woo, and he wipes off the water from his arms, takes off the coat, shakes it out, and puts it on the chair. You notice as well that his pant legs and his leather shoes are soaked to the core. Now, from this, you might conclude that it's raining outside, or that in the near past, it was raining outside. You might conclude that. But from what you can see so far, you might suppose that he had been working at a car wash, or he had been cleaning out the gutters, or that he was up on the roof cleaning off the roof, using water and so forth. So you're not completely justified in believing that it's raining out, because there's no other signs within the room that that's the case, besides the state of your friend when he comes in the room. Suppose further, though, after your friend comes in, that there's water sound up on the top of the roof, hitting the roof. And suppose that that sound is a common sound, which is accompanied by rain. See, at this point, there being rain sounds on top of the roof does not completely justify you in believing that there is rain. Once again, there may be some sort of leakage in the roof, or there may be some sort of cleaning activity of the roof going on, or perhaps some other explanation. Perhaps it rained last night and there's a number of trees hanging over the roof, and the wind has just picked up and it's blowing the held rain that remained on the tree's leaves, it's blowing those off onto your house. However, when you combine what you see in your friend and you combine the sound of rain on the roof, you begin to put together a cumulative case, a stronger and stronger case for thinking that, in fact, it is raining. And I believe that the arguments for God's existence, religious and mystical experience, the feeling that God is acting within our lives on a day-to-day basis, answering prayer, guiding, providentially leading, and so forth, as well as the veracity and life-changing power of scriptures, and the ministry, life, death, and resurrection of Christ, all these things together add up together to make a very, very strong and compelling case for theism. And so it seems to me that we have to realize that a cumulative case can be a good way to establish the best procedure for responding to Roe. Namely, God does exist. If he exists, then there's not gratuitous evil in the world. Therefore, there is not gratuitous evil in the world. That is, evil that occurs that God is not justified in permitting and that brings about no greater good for the person who suffers. There may seem to be gratuitous evils in the world. There may seem to be evils, that is, that God is not justified in permitting if he exists, or that do not bring about a greater good for those who suffer. However, that's the way that they seem. And my claim is that since we do not know all goods, we cannot move from, as Roe does, we cannot move from no goods we know of justifies God in allowing Sue and the fawn to suffer, to, therefore, probably no goods at all justify God in allowing E1 and E2. I believe that that's out for us. We cannot say for sure that that's the case. And so we return to that question about representative samples. Think about the set of all goods that we know of. Now, once again, to know of a good is just to be able to conceive of it. That's the way Roe is using goods we know of in that sense. Being in heaven with God, that's a good that I know about or know of, even though I haven't experienced, nor have I talked to anyone directly who has experienced that. So the question becomes, if I know just of a limited number of goods, how can I be sure that the goods I know of are representative of all the goods that there are? After all, if all the goods I knew of were representative of all the goods there were, then Roe might well be justified in concluding from premise 1 No goods we know of justify God in allowing Sue to suffer and the fawn to suffer. 2. Probably, therefore, no goods in any sense would justify God in allowing the fawn and Sue to suffer. That is, if we know that the set of goods we know about, that set is in fact biased, then we cannot use, well, two things. One, we cannot use that set as a representative set. And secondly, we therefore cannot conclude that there is no good at all in any sense that would justify God in allowing Sue and the fawn to suffer. Now, you know how representative samples go, right? If you went out into a mall area at a plaza and you started polling everyone how they were going to vote in the upcoming presidential election, and all the people said that they were supporting the Republican candidate, you might conclude from that, in an amazing sense, that everyone will in fact vote for that Republican candidate. Now, let's say you're amazed about your polling techniques, that everyone is voting for the Republican. You go back and tell your wife, this is amazing. Everyone's voting Republican. And she asks you where you took your representative sample from, and you said down at the plaza in the Eastland Mall, say. And your wife says, but didn't you hear? The Republican convention in this area, all their main executive officers were meeting down there today for a rally. Suddenly you realize from this other knowledge that you've gained from your wife that in fact your sample is biased. It's not representative of all voters. It's only in fact drawn from Republican peoples. And therefore, of course, they're going to vote Republican in the upcoming election. In the same way, on the next lecture especially, Stephen Weikstra argues that we know for sure that the goods we know about are not representative. Also, Paul Draper argues this way. This is the end of 9.